It's the Wonky Show. More students are in paid employment than ever before. Does that matter? Plus, the MAB is getting crunchy and the LLE has been in the Lords. It's all coming up.
I don't think it reflects that they regret having done it. I think it just goes, this wasn't what was sold to us. This isn't what we saw on the movies. This isn't what our mum and dad told us about. It was different, and it wasn't really what our predecessors had.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and joining me as usual to get across the week's big developments, three fabulous guests. In Hendon, Carol Ann Upton, he's Deputy Vice-Chancellor for Global Innovation and Impact at Middlesex University. Carol Ann, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, hi. My highlight of the week. Well, it's been a great week, actually, for highlights, but I was part of the launch of the R4R-like narrative CV by a group that's been working on this, and I've been part of that by UUK and UKRI working together. What was great about that is it was a genuine cross-sector collaboration.
Great stuff. Link for that in the show notes. In Heslington, Ben Vulliamies, Chief Exec at the University of York Students' Union. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning. My highlight of the week was last night, where me and my daughter, after several years waiting due to COVID disruption, got our Austrian citizenship officially conferred. And actually, we discovered that we can now vote in the Austrian elections, meaning for my daughter, who's only 13, that she will be able to vote at 16 for an Austrian government before she can vote for a British government.
Fantastic. And in Crewkerne, Somerset, James Coe is Associate Editor at Wonky. Jimbo, your highlight of the week, please.
Good morning, everyone. Ben, I look forward to the Austrian Democracy spin-off podcast that we can get involved in. So for those of you who've been following my trials and travails as a new dad via the Wonky podcast, I've taken up running again for the first time in 6 months. And yesterday I ran my first 5K as I get back into it. So that is my highlight of the week, Jim.
Great stuff. So yes, we start this week with the how do I pronounce this? SAES. The HEPI Advance HE Annual Survey on the Full-Time Undergraduate Student Experience is out. And Ben, there's big news on students at work.
Yeah, so the 10,000 UK undergraduate student respondents, and a lot stayed very consistent year on year. There's pretty much no change in the perception of a degree being good value. Very consistent around those who felt that the experience had exceeded their expectations. It's still at 19%, so not a huge amount. A very similar amount who would choose the same course and institution again. But the big story is the number of students who are now reporting that they are in paid employment. That's risen year on year from 45% to 55%. So for the first time ever, more students are reporting that they have to work alongside their studies than those who don't. And, these are students who are also reporting where they're working that they're more likely to consider leaving. They're less likely to say that they would choose the same course. And all of this suggests that we're at real risk of seeing a growing population forced into work because they can't afford their study. And that then that makes them more vulnerable to dropping out or being less happy.
Yes, Caroline, one of the really interesting things that I think was in there was I was kind of expecting, the kind of where HEPI can and Advance HE add up the total of the number of hours that students have kind of attended classes and the number of hours that they're actually kind of working in studying. I expected that to go down, but actually that's gone up. And when I interrogated the spreadsheet this morning, when I got off the sleeper, one of the things I found was the people who are working more hours are also the people who are studying more. And that must be quite punishing.
Yeah, I think there's all sorts of paradoxes in this report. But in some ways, it's stuff we've known for a long time. And anybody who's been teaching for a long time knows to expect that it's often been the students who are dealing with multiple responsibilities, caring responsibilities, whatever it is, work, other things, and fitting in their studies that have to be really organised and driven and motivated and often perform really well. But somehow there's something else going on here, I think, which is this mounting pressure that students are under to to juggle things. And then we shouldn't be at all surprised when that leads to students feeling stressed and not happy and worrying about their finances and their mental health and everything else. And I think it's been a problem in the sector for a long time that if we add up the hours in the week for students who are working increasingly long hours and studying notionally full time, that is more than the available hours in the week to them. And, you know, there's been a degree of complicity in this for a long time. And I think it feels like something is rising here that, you know, is going to burst and has to be addressed in the next few years, because it's just creating an intolerable pressure.
Yeah. James, look, I mean, you know, one of the things we've talked about on the podcast before is, you know, making the week on campus more flexible so that people can combine their kind of caring responsibilities and work with study. But one of the things that strikes me about that constant, you know, drive for more and more efficiency in the week of a student is it doesn't half put the pressure on, as Carol Ann says. And I was reflecting on your blog a few weeks ago about there not actually being any time to just kind of sit about and shoot the breeze.
Yeah, I mean, if for listeners who've not seen it, my blog about the quiet death of hanging out. So what my argument is that the value of universities in some regards is the time to get to do not very much at all, to get to spend time with friends, to get to pursue things you're interested in, to just spend time doing, you know, now it's as far as you want. I think the big bit for me, Jim, is that we should think about this as a choice, right? So if you look at the ONS statistics that came out in October, November time, what they basically said chimes with a lot of this. Students are going to work rather than studying. They're cutting back on social life. They're in some cases cutting down on bills and heating and eating or whatever. That is a fundamentally different set of choices facing students too. I choose to go to work because it's good for my CV. I choose to top up my maintenance grants a little bit. And I think the implications are profound. So it's not just that students are having a worse experience. It is almost a sense that a lot of programs are becoming part-time by default, not by design, because students simply cannot afford to be there because they are working instead. And secondly, to me, there's this sort of massive moral dilemma where we've geared our entire access conversation around get students in and then support their success. But if students can't materially function in an institution because of these enormous pressures on them, then how do we still maintain that access in and of itself is always a good thing? I think it is hugely difficult to square these circles.
Yes, and it feels like it might be coming to a crunch point, I guess. Ben, one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting in there was that kind of level of regret, the regret level, you know. And I've talked before about how our kind of regret level when people graduate appears to be higher than a number of other countries. I pulled out the Netherlands stat again on the blog this morning, but in particular, degree apprentices appear to be, you know, not having their expectations met, not having value for money, not experiencing belonging, and also saying it's bad value for money. What on earth is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you'll indulge me for a minute, I mean, the first thing I'd say, just going back to the amount of students who are having to seek employment alongside their study, this was not surprising. And I know I have spoken with a whole bunch of student union chief execs who share something over the last 6 months where suddenly we've got students who already work for us for maybe 15 hours a week coming to us and saying, I'm sorry, Ben, unless you can double the amount of hours available, I'm going to quit and go and work in town, probably a lower hourly rate, probably in a more unpleasant, less flexible job. So why don't you just give me the extra hours, Ben, and you know, help me afford to live? So this was very unsurprising, I'm afraid. Coming back to your question about kind of, you know, graduation dissatisfaction, I suppose. I think there's probably a whole bunch of things going on there that you know, the kind of rose-tinted view of what you get when you come to university over the last few years has not been the same as it would have been in the 3 years prior to a cost of living crisis and COVID, right? You know, they really are graduating into a very complex world where they feel that they're kind of pawns in all sorts of weird cultural wars, where they think the economy's changing shape, where they had less money to socialise and hang out and just procrastinate, as James suggests, where they were locked indoors for periods of time. I don't think it reflects that they regret having done it. I think it just goes, this wasn't what was sold to us. This isn't what we saw on the movies. This isn't what our mum and dad told us about. It was different, and it wasn't really what our predecessors had.
If I can just touch on that, like, I don't think regret in and of itself is always a negative thing. There's lots of things I regret. but it's the ability to do something about that regret. And unfortunately, we have a higher education system which is exceptionally inflexible. It is really hard to change your mind once you start doing something. The majority of programs are geared around a full-time education system, and we know part-time has dropped off. And when you read through the report, even if you look at these, you know, novel and emerging types of learning, like degree apprenticeships, they also turn out not to be all they're cracked up to be. It's really hard, if you regret it, to then not live continually through regret during your time of study. That there's not many other options if you realise whatever it isn't quite for you.
Yes, it's interesting, I think, that it's, you know, it's a report that is about full-time students. But, you know, there are various sections where you're reading it thinking, you know, they may not want to be, you know, half the number of credits part-time student with no maintenance support. They might just want to do, you know, they might just want a bit less study intensity. I guess we'll get to that when we talk about the LLE later. The other thing, though, Caroline, that I was thinking about on this work stuff, there's a couple of academics at your place that have done some really, really interesting stuff on what's actually happening to students in jobs these days. Because I still talk to people in universities who imagine that, you know, students are wandering off to a pleasant Saturday job in the local cafe, and actually they're often in a quite a miserable, you know, a kind of warehouse in the middle of the night sort of thing. Is there stuff do you think that we can do about pay and conditions and the quality of work that students are getting?
Certainly. I think there's a huge area of work to do there because, as you say, you know, you often find that students, when they are on campus, they're too tired to really be benefiting as they should, because they've maybe been working half the night and then travelling and commuting, and, you know, they're not having the sort of boarding school extended field trip that they see in the movies. And I think when you said it's not like they see in the films, you know, you touched there on a really important point, which is the expectations of student experience, I think, are still being based on a model of student life where people do hang out and where they all live communally and, you know, they kind of have extracurricular fun and activities. And that, particularly post-COVID, is not the lived experience of many students now. And I think many universities, certainly my own, are doing an awful lot to really adjust the student support and the offer to the reality of students' lives now. But that doesn't match what they see in the movies. And in a really outcomes-based system, we've also got students being led to believe that they should measure the value of their university experience by their salary on leaving. And of course, in the wake of COVID, that has also been affected to, you know, and students are graduating and going, well, where are all these opportunities that I thought were going to be there? Everything's changed. So I think both in terms of experience and outcomes, there's still a huge amount of uncertainty hanging over students. And in terms of the work, I mean, you mentioned the research on the work. One of the things that's very apparent is that students often are not clear or confident about their rights as employees. And I think there are still people out there who are willing to exploit students and to offer them, you know, a valuable learning experience in inverted commas, which is often a compromise for the pay and conditions that they should have. So I think there's still work to do in making sure that students are really clear on their rights and they understand what they can and can't ask for, but also in making sure that we represent the student experience and that we measure the value of what we're offering in a way that is realistic and updated. And I don't think as a sector we've always been great at that.
Just on that, Caroline, I think you're entirely right. And Jim, when I was reading your blog this morning talking about this bifurcated student experience between the people who can access, you know, basically cash capital to do stuff and then the people who can't. And I suppose what I'm struck by is we risk ending up this system where there's a group of students who can keep doing stuff because of dint of their background, who will then benefit from that sort of stereotype or traditional benefits we see of students. There's a group of students who are going to be entirely reliant on universities' ability to provide bursaries and support and advice, of which we know is particularly difficult given the financial circumstances universities face. And then I think there's probably this group in the middle who are neither so struggling as to take advantage or benefit from the range of things universities can offer, but are neither so advantaged that they are going on the field trips and doing all of these bits and pieces of work and extracurricular stuff. So we end up with this unhappy squeezed middle, And then on the other end, this sort of disadvantaged group who aren't getting the benefits anyway. And I suspect that group is going to get larger unless something drastic happens with maintenance or support or university approaches.
Can I come in on that? Because the earlier this week I was reading the Office for Students annual report, and the kind of the comparison of what we can read in Lord Wharton's foreword on that document to what the data is telling us from HEPI and Advanced HE is really quite stark. So the eminently unconflicted Lord Wharton said in his opening remarks on the annual accounts that we regulate to ensure students have a good academic experience and that they get value for their investment. He went on to say that in a year where students faced added cost of living pressure, that's even more important. And I can't help but feel that as the OFS chair, he should use some of his very close ties to government to demand more than a 2.8% increase in the maximum available student loans, because he knows that there's continued bad news about inflation and students are hyper exposed to that with their rent and their travel and their food, all subject to inflationary pressure. And now we've got a bunch of HEPI and Advanced HE data telling us that they're all forced to work excessive hours on top of their study as well. He's in a position, you know, he's set himself the challenge of kind of existing and brokering in that exact space. And I'm not seeing a lot of action there.
Yes, I mean, and, you know, that inflation question is really interesting, isn't it? I mean, when we record on Thursday, inflation figures are out today, and obviously that's a big news story in the wider kind of macroeconomics of the country. But food inflation is 18.4%. Milk, cheese and eggs is 27% year on year. Renting a room, median rent, 8.3% up. And the maximum maintenance loan in England is going up 2.8%. And of course, the other thing I keep saying to people about the maintenance loan is, because wages are going up quite fast, and because the threshold over which you can, you know, you can't any longer claim the maximum maintenance loan is fixed, a huge number of families are going to be ripped out of being able to claim even the maximum maintenance loan this September, which is extraordinary, really. And you know, there doesn't seem to be a way out of this, does there? I mean, anyone got any ideas about how to persuade the government to not keep rolling out the same 15 million quid twig that it does?
I mean, in terms of how to persuade the government, Jim, it's not an economic argument, is it? There's no way you can look at the current situation that students are facing into and say, actually, I think this is satisfactory and it's fine. There is this whole moral argument piece here of basically what we're saying to students coming in is, yes, we know you won't have enough to survive and your maintenance loan now tracks below the minimum wage according to the latest statistics, but I'm sure it'll turn out fine in the end. I mean, it's absurd. And I think the two things that I think about is on the ONS statistics out in October and November, more students taking on credit and alternative forms of loan in order to support their studies. And then we think about how these students are going out into the world, where the argument with student loans has always been, well, they're not really a proper type of loan. But now students are undertaking proper types of loans as well.
So what is that going to do? You know, Klarna-style loans. Yeah.
I mean, I kid you not, I was walking around a university probably 2 or 3 months ago, and there was posters up on the walls for pre-loans on student loans in order to arrive in your bank earlier and spread out. I mean, these are the real conditions that happens when basically you say to students that poverty is okay. It's absurd.
It's grim stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ben, on this, you know, let's just divert for a minute on some of the moral questions. Obviously, one of the interesting bits in here was also on free speech and, you know, the revelation, although we kind of knew this already, the revelation that it turns out that whilst there is a, you know, a small group of students who, you know, don't think they can express themselves on campus for all sorts of reasons, the groups on campus that don't feel they can express themselves is an EDI concern, not necessarily the way it's kind of painted in the press. And I have this sense that universities are going to get their NSS stats, look at the analysis and think, we need to target, I don't know, black and minority ethnic students or LGBT plus students. And if they do that, Arif Ahmed will be going, don't you dare, because that's all wokery.
Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Honestly, the honest truth, if I think about students exclusively for a minute, I think students are kind of broadly aware of the noise around free speech coming at them from every direction. And they know they're being accused of being snowflakes at the same time as being accused of filibustering free speech and so on and so on. They're just tired and bored of it. And they're frankly disinterested in the critical mass by a long way. You know, they feel like they are now the subject of culture wars and they're just going to sit there being kicked from left to right. I think you're right that universities and unions are now having to, students' unions are having to think about what is our role in helping our broader communities to navigate that space. And I'm not convinced it's the right thing for us to be prioritising our time on when, as we can see, there are students who are struggling with the cost of living. But, you know, those are the cards we've been dealt.
Mm. Caroline, just before we finish on this, obviously one of the things it's actually quite hard to discern in here is that although students are working harder, and although there are some stats about, you know, how many lectures and seminars are being held online or in person, what we can't quite see is the extent to which students are, you know, asynchronously experiencing teaching and learning rather than being on campus, you know, kind of having to choose to not come to campus. What's your sense of, you know, that kind of post-COVID debate about being on campus? What's your sense about where that's at?
I think it's still unresolved. It feels unresolved to me. I think we're still trying to hold on to the benefits of the in terms of the flexibility that it gave to students to be able to work from home or from different places and not have to do ridiculous amounts of travelling. And I speak as someone who works in a university where very many of our students do live at home and commute across London. So we already have a slightly different model from that which is, you know, set up as the norm, I think, in the sector of having residential students. So most of our students are already commuting, and the hybrid mode gives them some flexibility to be able to do that more efficiently and spend their time more efficiently and reduce the cost of unnecessary travel. So that is good. I think there are things we're not seeing. I think we're not seeing yet quite how it's affecting students' reflection time, students' engagement with work beyond the fixed contact hours. I think we're not quite seeing yet how it's affecting their social engagements. But what we are already starting to see is the impact on non-continuation of students from particularly from the more disadvantaged groups that are just finding the pressure financially really intolerable and are not making the value for money argument stack up. And I think what we're going to see, if we're not really careful, is increasing an increasing gap between the rich and poor, if I can put it that way. But the disadvantaged in our communities are really the ones that are going to suffer the most as this continues, because they're just trying to square circles that ultimately can't be squared, and that's very painful. I think we've got to keep an eye on this really closely over the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, great stuff. Lots of stuff on the site about the Student Academic Experience Survey. Probably more to come as we dive further into the crosstabs. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Mac Marshall. I'm the outgoing education officer at Newcastle University Students' Union. This week for Wonky, I've been writing about queering higher education. As it's Pride Month, it seemed appropriate to consider what queering higher education actually looks like. And through looking at representation, celebrating and championing, and support services, including the dreaded extenuating circumstances forms, how these are all key facets to making HE more accessible for queer students. And it's a really good opportunity for outgoing and incoming officers to consider how we can foster inclusive practices, pedagogy and processes and create safer spaces for LGBTQ+ students on campus.
Now, UCU's marking and assessment boycott rolls on. James, what's the latest?
So, marking assessment boycott, action over pay and working conditions set to continue up to September 2023, potentially. The details of what's inspired this, the nature of the actions, all available on the Wonky site, so I won't go through it now. But I think a few things that are of note. So, what does the Office for Students expect providers to do where there is a marking and assessment boycott? Well, they've written to heads of institutions to say we expect three things. Number one, that students are not disadvantaged. Number two, that students can graduate. And number three, that degrees reflect actual achievements.
Kind of three-way seesaw.
Yes, and a very, very difficult balancing act to extend and spoil that metaphor. So, if you expect that, what conditions do they think universities should be worried about? They think they should be worried about C1, consumer protection law. Are students getting what they were promised in going in a marking assessment boycott? They are concerned about B1 and B2. Is there a high-quality academic experience? experience? B4, is there effective assessment? And E2, are universities operating in the way their governing docs say they will? Interestingly, we are starting to get a lot of nuance and new viewpoints emerging about the marking assessment boycott. The Office of the Independent Adjudicator has said that universities should be providing more clarity about conditions, appeals and the like. The chief executive of UCEA, the employer's representative, has written for Wonky recently, asking for a shared perspective about university finances so that UCU and UCEA are talking from a shared point of view. If you read the 13 comments underneath that blog, it is clear from UCU's perspective that this isn't about a shared perspective, but is actually about the material conditions of people they represent. And we're also now starting to hear from universities themselves. So the Exeter University Executive and their UCU branch have called for a re-engagement. I think probably most importantly in this, the students. If you are following Twitter in the education space even lightly, you will see lots of complaints over things like receiving participation awards, about temporary marking, about the quality of feedback. So this looks set to rumble on without an obvious solution in sight. All the while, stakeholders and the OFS are certainly getting twitchier about what is happening.
Yes. Now, Ben, I will be genuinely trying to be careful about how I say this, because I'm not actually trying to wind people up when I say this. But one of the things that I think is really interesting here is clearly a really widespread, deep impact is not happening. So, you know, there are clearly, you know, 10, 15, maybe 20 universities where this is hitting hard, where, you know, universities are unable to cover the marking through other staff. And even in those 10 or 20, often it's pockets, it's particular departments and so on. And, you know, there's no doubt that if you're in the middle of that and you've been taking action, it will feel like the whole sector. But I have to say, sometimes I'm on social media and people are saying the entire sector is being engulfed with blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, no, you're talking about parts of the Russell Group. And the danger, I think, there is that it's really hard to see how collective bargaining can, you know, when every university is in the mix, can ever get to a point where it says, well, okay, well, there's 20 of you where, you know, that's happening. We'll accede to your demands because there's 20 of you. I mean, you know, you would love to think, I think UCU would love to think that, you know, everyone would do the greater good thing, but that's kind of not how it works, is it?
I totally agree with some of that analysis. So, again, I've been spending time with networks of student union chief execs, been kind of comparing and contrasting notes about the scale of the impact and how it's been received by students and what the mitigating actions are. This appears, on my kind of unqualified sample, this appears to be an almost exclusively Russell Group problem. Even within the Russell Group, it's very clustered around particular academic departments. I don't really want to kind of name names, but, you know, there's only one department at York where there is widespread impact. You know, it's almost untouching any other academic discipline, right? It is clustering and it's splitting, you know, staff, it's splitting UCU members, it's splitting students in terms of the impact, it's splitting institutions, if I'm right, and it's an overwhelmingly a Russell Group problem. I think the other thing I'd say on kind of differing impacts, so I know I was guilty when I was trying to kind of think about how MAP was going to affect students at my institution, and I was kind of overly concentrated on, you know, on what happens if I don't get a mark and how was that be mitigated. Increasingly, what we're seeing, not just at York but elsewhere, I've seen some kind of wonderful Twitter threads on this where students are sharing some awful, some embarrassing feedback. And so these are instances where students are actually getting marks, but as you know, feedback like "what an interesting piece." I mean, that is not feedback. That's provocative, frankly.
Spelled PEACE.
Well, exactly. And so if you get a borderline mark, you know, all your worry about am I going to get a mark is now gone. But then you're going, right, so why have I got a borderline mark? What does it mean? What do I take away from this? And you're given a kind of one line statement of nothingness about your piece of work. Suddenly, your anger is not about the mark at all. It's about the actual, the kind of depth of the learning experience. I think question 14 on NSS is going to take an absolute pummeling in Russell Group institutions based on some of the stuff I've seen shared on social media.
I mean, Caroline, obviously, you know, I think that, you know, there's a kind of differential impact, but in many ways, there isn't a differential reputational hit, is there? Because it's often this group of universities that the press talk about. It's often this group of universities that, you know, international observers will look at. There is potentially, depending on how it's handled, a real reputational hit to the sector.
Yeah, I think that's right. quite, but we always have this problem when there's something which is quite nuanced and on which there's quite a lot of discussion in the sector, that just isn't going to be that isn't going to be understood or reflected in the wider perception of what's going on or the wider coverage of it. And so it is just going to come across as, you know, those overprivileged universities, you know, mistreating their students yet again. And I think that's a real shame, because that isn't the reality. Actually, people work really, really hard in all sorts of roles in the sector to make sure that the students are very well served. And most people who work in higher education don't do it primarily for the money. That's not to say they don't deserve to be adequately rewarded, but they come into it because they're driven by passion, and the passion is often for providing excellent student learning experiences and student learning outcomes. And so I think it really is frustrating. It does us all a disservice when things like this potentially give ammunition to the parts of the press and beyond that just want to say bad things about universities and misrepresent the care that goes on in them.
James, I mean, we were talking earlier in many ways about kind of Tailor Two Cities with students. I guess one of the things that has kind of really come to the fore during the dispute is the extent to which some universities are probably able to meet the demands relatively comfortably, and other universities, you know, are in the middle of redundancy programs or freezes on, you know, quite significant freezes on redundancies, both explosions and implosions, as I would call them. Is, you know, can that, notwithstanding, you know, the kind of, you know, in principle tweets that I see, which are about, you know, redistributing money or student numbers, which, you know, don't feel within the realm of possibility, at least right now, can national pay bargaining survive?
Straightforward question there, Jim. I think there's a couple of perspectives here. So I think one of the reasons why the action seems to be getting more attention, more vocal, more extreme is the wrong word, but I suppose more vociferous, is that there was a point where a resolution seemed eminently possible. So if we think of not so long ago, UCA said that their offer of an improved pay deal worth between 5% and 8%. They're saying, look, this is our highest pay offer in nearly 20 years. Participating UCU members rejected that at a 56% threshold. So it's not miles away. But I think the problem is, if we think of what is the dynamic here, well, as you say, there are institutions at the top who you may presume actually would seek a more generous pay settlement in order to settle the disputes. There are institutions who have less finance who actually, the pay settlement as it is going to have knock-on effects to their ability to employ more staff, their ability to invest in services, etc., etc. So I think I get where when the chief executive UCA wrote, we need to develop this shared financial perspective. But I don't think the perspective is the problem. I think the problem is the, I don't use the word bifurcation again, but this huge gap we are seeing with institutions who can afford to absorb pay increases, changes to pensions, etc., and those who simply cannot survive to do it. So what do I think will happen then in the long term of collective bargaining? I think there is no incentive to move away from it at a political dimension, because as soon as you get into one-to-one negotiation, it becomes much harder for institutions and much harder for unions too. And generally, I think collective is a better thing than not. But in terms of the economic position, it is clearly not feasible for the institutions who are saying, I can't afford a pay increase, to be forever dragged along larger pay increases. What I suspect we might see is more actions like when that Cambridge College bought themselves out of the pension fund, of institutions doing things like one-off pay awards, one bonuses, etc., etc., in the hope of quelling down local action. So collectivism will survive, but with significant local variations within it.
Yeah, with lots of kind of, you know, bells and whistles and tweaks and so on.
Yeah, and like extra holidays and bank holidays and one-off bits of cash and, you know, puppy rooms or whatever. There'll be bits and pieces of trying to quell local disputes.
Ben, where I've got into, you know, kind of discussion, I'll put that in air quotes, discussions with people on social media, is one of the things that I've often reflected on this year with, you know, there's been lots of strife in the public sector, is that most of the kind of other public sector pay disputes have tended to have ministers as their target, right? You know, they've not really talked so much about the kind of local bosses. They've talked very much about ministers. Now, obviously, UCU went in quite hard fairly early on vice chancellors, and you know their perspective is their perspective, which is about, you know, large salaries and mismanagement and those sorts of things. But you know, I guess my hypothesis is that has taken actually a bit of pressure off you know, ministers to actually solve the funding problem. It's really interesting that whenever there's a row with schools, we get a press release from the Secretary of State. We never get a press release from the Secretary of State about the higher education dispute. And there must be, you know, that must be having impacts in terms of the amount of pressure you feel to go and, you know, argue with the Treasury.
Totally. And this, look, this is an economic problem, regardless of your perspective, regardless of whether you're talking about it as a student saying this is how much I've spent and you won't mark my work, regardless of whether you're a staff member and an academic saying, you know, this is how much economy I create within the institution and you'll only pay me that much, regardless of whether you're a vice chancellor saying I'm trying to deliver wonderful enriching experiences to thousands of students and train up nurses and doctors and teachers, but the government have capped me at this much money. So it's all about the economy, and it's an economy that was created by ministers. I totally think it feels like almost navel gazing that we're arguing with each other when we haven't really got the levers to pull.
Carol Anne, I mean, look, do fees need to go up?
Something needs to go up. I mean, I think, you know, the point was made earlier about lack of understanding of university finances, and I think the lack of understanding beyond universities and even within them of university finances is something that desperately needs to be addressed. I mean, we could go back a long way in sort of policy history to right back to the introduction of fees, and I'm old enough to remember that. And I don't think there was very much public understanding then that the introduction of fees was being accompanied by a removal of grants. And the different basis for funding of universities has never been very well understood. And the freeze on the cap on the UK fee is causing massive problems. And that is the fundamental problem. The student loan book, the cap on the fee, that is something that just isn't working. I don't know what the answer is. Thank goodness it's not quite my job to solve it. But it is an economic problem, and it is a formula that just isn't working. And I did hope when COVID hit and we had the discussion started to emerge around international students and the costs of research and all of that kind of funding model that underpinned the funding of the sector in the UK, that we might start a discussion towards really looking at the reality of how universities are resourced now. That seems to have gone quiet for all sorts of reasons, but we're left in this really difficult position with more or less fixed income and rising costs. And that's...
Yes, just on that, Caroline, I don't know the answer either, but I think it's... I mean, to your question, Jim, putting up fees, i.e. charging students, say, £13,000 a year rather than £1,950, is going to be politically unpalatable and likely impossible in current financial situation. The alternative of just get more students who are in the uncapped, in uncapped fees, i.e. international students or PGTs, I'm not sure is possible for everybody, and there's clearly a moral dimension. So the options you are left with, short of universities en masse, cutting what is seen as additional, which i.e. stuff outside of teaching research that tends to be the student experience type things that we think really important, is only direct cash transfers from governments to universities, which is increasing the level of top-up. I can't see another solution that seems politically possible and would actually solve the problem.
Well, now the sun's out and our mind turns to festivals. Mark is here with details of one of our own.
The Festival of Higher Education is coming. This November, Wonky and the University of London will welcome you to Senate House for two amazing days of one-to-one conversations with HE leaders, set-piece debates and insights from journalists, policymakers and experts. You'll hear from speakers inside and outside the sector, take part in amazing interactive sessions, learn about new research, data and ideas, and meet colleagues old and new, all equipping you with the fresh thinking and insights ready to take back and share with your universities and teams. It's going to be an unmissable event for anyone with an interest in the future of UK higher education. That's 7th and 8th of November in London. Early bird tickets are available only until the end of June, so do hurry if you want to take advantage of these. Find out more and book your tickets at thefestivalofhe.com or follow the links from Wonky. We can't wait to see you in November.
Now, finally, the Lifelong Learning Higher Education Fee Limits Bill is in the House of Lords. Caroline, what's going on there?
So we've just had the second reading of the bill. And it is worth a look at what the Lords have been, what questions the Lords have been asking about it, because of I had a read of it and I thought there were some really good questions. Unfortunately, not too many answers yet. So I think the sector will welcome this bill and they'll welcome the proposal and they'll welcome the principle of it, because as James said earlier, I think our model is exceptionally inflexible and the majority of programmes are still geared around that three-year monolithic degree programme. And we've had various attempts to introduce a bit more flexibility to reflect some of the lifestyle pressures and the financial pressures that we were talking about even at the beginning of the programme today. But it's very difficult to make it work. And what's singularly lacking at the moment is the detail. As with all things, but particularly with this, the devil will be in the detail. So we've got nothing about eligibility, we've got nothing about maintenance. That's a really big gap. And even the sort of long-term viability of the funding amounts that have been set out, you know, given what we've been talking about and all the uncertain futures around what things might cost and who might pay for it and how students might manage that experience financially. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty really when you're looking at something which has a long horizon, a far horizon into the future.
So this is, I judge, a sensible technical bill. But the question is, in the real world, will it actually be an impactful bill? And there, I think we have to acknowledge uncertainty. The government's own impact assessment says, quote, "It is too early to confidently predict the likely response of providers and learners to the introduction of the LLE fee limits and the impact on provision, choice and take-up." That is true, but I want to suggest that beneficial impact will likely need five further actions. Two on the demand side, as it were, to widen eligibility for lifelong learning support, and three on the supply side to widen educational provision. On the demand side, there are, I'm afraid, some early signs that the proposed approach to lifelong learning fee support may struggle to attract many people. The Department for Education and the OFS short courses trial, as I understand it, has so far only advanced loans to 37 people looking for new skills or career changes, which, as David Cunahan has pointed out, is rather fewer than the number of MPs who are leaving at the time of the next election looking for new skills and career changes.
You know, there are obviously big questions here about, you know, logistics, all sorts of questions about whether there's any actual demand for this, which, you know, DK has gone over, certainly in terms of the trials. But, I mean, Ben, you know, one of the things that really strikes me is there's actually, in theory here, quite a lot of thinking about the way in which you can, you know, effectively apply the credit system to the student loan system when it comes to maximum tuition fees. But, you know, as Caroline says, there's nothing in there on maintenance. So, you know, for example, if a student said, "I want to use my entitlement to do 120 credits, you know, across three years. Do you know what I mean? Like, lots of this stuff hasn't been thought through. I said, you know, what if a student just doesn't want to be full-time in the way that we've talked about at the top of the show? You know, perhaps because they've got a really demanding part-time work, you know, they've just had a bereavement or something. That no thinking has been put in there, which I just find astonishing.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And yet, from a really selfish point of view, I'm doing a master's at the moment. And when I decided I wanted to do a master's, actually, I didn't decide I wanted to do a master's. I decided I wanted to learn. I wanted to develop. And so I start looking at what's out there. And, you know, I'm guilty of, you know, searching for a particular master's cut. I probably started off searching for MBAs or something. I can't remember. But you know, as a full-time employee with a family based in the north, a young family, and I'm based in the north, and, you know, with commitments and with COVID going on, I'm sat there and I'm trying to think about, well, you know, actually, I need to find a course that's flexible enough for me to duck in and duck out. Is it going to be in person? Is it part-time? Is it full-time? You know, there's loads of questions that I'm trying to explore there. And it was really bloody difficult to try and find a course that was accessible to me as a mature student with commitments in my life. And I won't be the only one, right? And And I'm on the penultimate assignment for that right now.
I can never remember a time when you weren't doing that, Matthew.
I'm on the penultimate assignment now, and I'm looking back and thinking, do you know what? Maybe with the benefit of hindsight, if there had have been an option available to me just to do module A, B, and C, maybe I'd have taken that and not given away quite so much of my life. Do you know what I mean? But that wasn't an easily available option. So the modular principle is good
in principle, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, I totally agree that, you know, how would the funding work for something that's a bit more modular? I think some universities, and again, you know, when I was looking at which universities could actually accommodate my learning needs, frankly, there weren't very many. You know, like the way that I wanted to learn, you know, just wasn't accommodated for as a mature student with a job and a family and based in the north of England. And so the options were really, really limited. And I guess, you know, we've set out a vision here for lifelong learning, which I think is important and exciting and is the right vision. You're right, there's a lot of work to do to work out how that is translated into real opportunities.
I mean, you know, Jim, Ben, Caroline, do tell me you think otherwise, but I still can't work out who lifelong learning is for. So, in theory, do I think it is a very good thing that more people can study in different ways at different times of their lives, particularly where they've not had the benefits of qualifications in the past? Yes, absolutely. Who are the students who are not interested in the residential model of which university is built around and simultaneously do not want to go full-time to their local institution, whose employers are flexible enough to allow them to learn through different models and have the prerequisite qualifications which presumably universities will still ask for? It seems to me to be a quite small pool we are fishing in. I'm not convinced that this is going to be more impactful than thinking about the tweaks that could be done to things like student finance allowances for part-time learning, to looking at increasing the eligibility and uptake of degree apprenticeships, which are primarily routes to MBAs for people already in employment, and also through making online study more ubiquitous, but all the political messaging is more people should go face-to-face. So I think it is a great idea. I'm still not sure where the demand is coming from.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Caroline, Ben, Jimbo and news editor Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. Mark will be here next week, I promise. And until then, stay wonky.